Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the fourth annual Honor Frost Foundation lecture. We're all delighted to have you here. Afterwards, there will be the opportunity to meet with the trustees and other advisors for the foundation. But right now, we have the honor of having Dr. Alexandra Willing and Dr. Ross Thomas talk about their work at Naukratis. And as you probably have all looked at the website, you would have seen that this is actually really brand new, groundbreaking work that they're doing there. The website's quite exciting, their website, not ours, but ours is quite interesting too. And I think the Honor Frost Foundation can take some pride in the fact that they have enabled this work, this field work, to go ahead. Hopefully he'll say this, but without us, it would have been quite a difficult thing to do. And what I found so exciting about this work is the connectivity in the Eastern Mediterranean, which I think you'll find when they both have their sessions tonight. As you know, they're both at the British Museum. You might wonder why we were sponsoring two people from Greek and Roman when we're Eastern Mediterranean, but this talk will obviously share with you the really exciting new developments at this exciting project at the British Museum. And without further ado, I'm actually going to hand over, but before I do, I would like to say that trustees have decided to award one more year's grant to this fieldwork project.
Thank you, Joan. So we'd like to thank the Honor Frost Foundation for inviting us to talk today about the results from the important excavations that they have funded at Naukratis. The topic of today's lecture is the port town of Naukratis, although you'll hear today various pronunciations of that name. The name in Greek means mistress of ships. We are going to focus today on how our new research on Naukratis has improved our understanding of this major international trade harbour. The ancient Greek historian Herodotus stated that Naukratis was not only the base for Greek traders in Egypt, but had a monopoly on trade coming into Egypt. Subsequently, 18th and 19th century scholarship was fascinated by Naukratis, a cosmopolitan harbour town where cultures mixed and mingled and exotic trade goods from all over the ancient world converged. Comparisons were made with the ports of the Hanseatic League, or Hong Kong, and the Portuguese and Dutch trading posts at Nagasaki. But the location of the port was lost until rediscovery by the pioneer of Egyptian and Near Eastern archaeology, Flinders Petrie, discovered the site in 1884. A major discovery that made it into all handbooks and university curricula, including the classes of a certain well-known archaeological professor. He was not in his office. And that's not how you pronounce the site either, but never mind. He was here discussing Petrie's 1885 excavations at Naukratis. And it was, in fact, a Cypriot figurine that led to the discovery of Naukratis. This figurine was offered to Petrie whilst he was surveying the pyramids of Giza. Petrie then excavated the site himself with Gardner for the Egypt Exploration Fund between 1884-6. They discovered a cemetery, sanctuaries of the Dioscuroi, Apollo, Hera, Aphrodite, and a large Egyptian temple complex, and also scarab metal and ceramic workshops within what was assumed to be a Greek town. This was pioneering archaeological work for its time, including the earliest attempts at stratigraphic excavation in Egypt. Then followed excavations by Hogarth for the British School of Athens in 1899 and 1903, who importantly discovered the Greek sanctuaries within the Hellenion, an important Greek structure. The wide trading networks that those visiting Naukratis participated in crossed much of the ancient world. This is clear from the wide variety of objects found at Naukratis. Naukratis was an important node of international networks of the Eastern Mediterranean, linking the riverine landscapes of the delta with the maritime landscape of the Mediterranean, connecting the capital in the 7th century BC Sais and the important city of Memphis with the Mediterranean ports of Thonis Heraklion and subsequently Alexandria. It is here that goods from Greece and Egypt changed hands. Egyptian exports of grain, natural resources and semi-luxuries were exchanged for Greek, Cypriot and Phoenician silver, wine and oil. The Naucratis project was developed by Alexandra Willing because this crucially important site to Otter scholarship was poorly understood. But the project was not easy to deliver because previous publication was so incomplete. But also, the collection of artefacts was widely distributed. In fact, over 70 different locations around the world. These challenges hindered and often misled subsequent scholarship. Work on the Naucratis at the British Museum started in 2002, and since 2008, the Naucratis project was developed into a major research project. And since 2011, brought in myself and others to work on three main components of the project: study, restudy of the old excavations, analysis of the finds that derive from these excavations, as well as new fieldwork, which I have been directing in the field since 2012, funded by the Honor Frost Foundation. This was essential to reassess the old fieldwork and to answer questions that cannot be addressed by study of old fieldwork alone. To achieve our aims, much data had to be gathered, resulting in large international collaborations involving many specialists. This is a complex project of many components. With major milestones achieved earlier this year, including the online research publication freely accessible for all researchers of all objects discovered at the site, with chapters on the history of the site and its artifacts, the catalogue is complete, and the research that it has generated is ongoing, with further results expected soon. And the important fieldwork component is ongoing, with a particular focus on Naucratis as a harbour and trading port, her riverine and maritime aspects, which were never fully explored. I will now present the results from our new fieldwork, and Alexandra will follow this with a synthesis of what the Naucratis project can tell us about its population, trade and its wider context. New fieldwork at Naucratis started in 2012 with three main objectives: to integrate previous research, understand the location of the Canopic River, which crucially connected Naucratis to the sea, its navigability and the wider landscape. But we also wanted to understand the city layout and sanctuaries and be able to present this to both an academic and also a general audience. In so doing, we have used a wide variety of techniques, resources and equipment: satellite images, archival material, topographic survey, surface pottery collection, geophysics such as fluxgate radiometers and electronic resistance tomography, I'll need some water in a second, and geological auger core survey and excavation. Finally, and most importantly, we wanted to develop local skills through a field school and have been training local antiquities inspectors and local archaeologists from the region how to use the equipment that we use, survey and excavate Naucratis carefully. Our constant presence, but mostly the enthusiasm of those inspectors we have trained and kept in touch with, have been crucial to the protection of this unique settlement from the constant threat of development. Integrating past fieldwork has been difficult, without any reliable maps produced by any of the previous excavators. All of the survey methodologies we have used, along with the archival research into the old survey notebooks, were crucial to locate the areas excavated by Petrie and Hogarth, which revealed a large 30-hectare settlement. A large range of finds were preserved from the early fieldwork, covering over 1,000 years of the site's history from the 7th century BC to the 7th century AD. They include many archaic and classical Greek imports, but also Egyptian, Roman, and late antique finds, as well as hundreds of Cypriot figurines. They were concentrated within or adjacent to the Greek sanctuaries. These were found mainly in early Saite levels, so levels of the 7th and 6th centuries BC, that Petrie was able to use correctly some of these pieces to date the founding of the Greek temples and Naucratis to the end of the 7th century BC. These represent a significant contact between Egypt through Naucratis with Cyprus and the Levant, which Alexandra will discuss further. William Coulson and Albert Leonard Jr. introduced new scientific methodologies in 1978, including field survey and geological orbit core survey. However, they were hindered by a large lake occupying the whole area of the old excavations, which has now been drained, and failed to recognize, much of the early Egyptian material and introduced some major survey and interpretive errors that have hindered subsequent scholarship. These include locating the Canopic River, which connected Naucratis to the sea, through the middle of the site whilst the site was occupied, which seems a bit impossible. Subsequent rescue excavations by Sabri Shukri and Muhammad Ali Hakim of the Egyptian Antiquities Service were easily incorporated into our own survey as we work very closely with these local archaeologists. Their important contribution is incorporated here, and we are working with them to publish this material within our own planned monograph series on our excavations. Despite the wealth and importance of Naucratis coming largely from its function as a port, previously, maritime aspects of Naucratis were largely ignored. The previous excavators ignored areas of the site that would tell us more about the harbours and key areas, as a result, maritime artefacts were rarely found. And those that were largely ignored or misidentified. Even representations of ships and boats from Naucratis were rare and only depicted stylized boats such as these 6th century representations on this black figure and on this 6th century Egyptian amulet. None of these representations represent something that would have actually travelled to Naucratis, for example. And so, in 2011, when we started working on a reconstruction of Naucratis for a documentary, we had a very misleading impression about what the settlement looked like based on this earlier research and what vessels frequented there, and could only assume where the riverfront was located. But this was instantly recognized in 2012 from the magnetometry that we undertook on the site, seen in grey above. The river lay to the west, and structures built along its bank included warehouses and terraces. The river did not run through the site whilst it was occupied, as suggested by Villis, the geologist working for Coulson's mission. So since 2013, we enlisted the help of Ben Pennington, a geologist at Southampton University, who has undertaken a survey drilling 35 auger cores and reinterpreting the previous work of Villis, undertaken in the 70s, and assisted with electronic resistance tomography survey. Sections undertaken by Chris Strutt, also of Southampton, provide a section of the site. These clearly show a river to the west in orange and yellow. These confirm that the Canopic branch of the river was located to the west of the settlement and was at least 5 metres deep and approximately 200 metres wide when first settled in 620 BC and when the river first abutted the site, before this migrated westwards 86 metres by the 7th century AD. The river ceased to flow during the later first millennium AD, after which it was canalised by the Alexandrian Canal dug during either the Ayyubid or Mamluk periods. This later canal, now called the Abu Diab Canal, no longer respects the site. This is Naucratis entirely. So, with an average depth of some 5 metres and a depth next to the bank measured up to 4.3 metres, the Canopic branch afforded navigational capacity for the large vessels carrying grain shipments to Alexandria all year round during seasons of both high and low Nile. at least until the latest papological evidence of AD 374. The so-called Pleuron Hellenicon, or Greek boat that copied Mediterranean seagoing ships with a capacity of up to 60 tons, frequently sailed this river. And with a draft of some 1.5 metres, the early 4th century BC Kyrenia ship, a merchant ship that sank off of Cyprus with 17 tons of cargo in the early 3rd century BC, would also have easily been able to navigate the Canopic River. The geological work has now refined the western limit of the site, whilst our survey and the geophysical work has revealed a 60-hectare settlement, much larger than previously thought. I will now briefly describe the major findings from our survey and excavations on the riverbank to the west, the Egyptian sanctuary of Amun-Ra to the south, and the Greek sanctuaries of the Dioscoroi and the Hellenion to the north, where we have opened up a number of trenches. So in 2015, Edwin de Vries opened up a trench for us across part of the accessible 330-metre-long stretch of the ancient riverbank. This was just in front of the town and across the riverbank as it silted up between the 5th and the 3rd centuries BC. Within these layers were numerous examples of imported pottery and of the Persian period, under early Ptolemaic levels. Imports were largely attic, fine wares, but also included trade amphora with pine pitch still preserved. The bank at this location and this period was just a hardened slope down to the water, consolidated with rubble. And this was evidently also the location of domestic dumps, including fauna and preserved grains and cooking pots, but also sea-worn ballast stones from the Mediterranean. Also within the waterlogged deposits were a number of figurines, possibly richly deposited during one of the well-documented Egyptian festivals related to the inundation of the Nile, such as the so-called Festival of Drunkenness. These included Egyptian terracotta figurines of Isis Hathor in a shrine, a cultist holding a model phallus and a wine amphora, and a wooden phallus. We also had a rider wearing Persian dress, and nearby a small limestone altar was found. In addition, exceptionally rare evidence of Mediterranean shipbuilding technology in the form of a plank scarf end with a mortise tenon and dowel joinery was found within 5th or early 4th century BC deposits. Archaeological evidence for ships of the 5th century BC are relatively rare, and yet in just a single trench on this 1 kilometre-long bank of Naucratis, we find this rare new evidence of ship technology. There are probably many more fragments of ship technology and maintenance within the accessible 330-metre stretch of the river harbour that we are planning to excavate next season, which we now just discovered has been funded. Thank you very much. These new finds complement the maritime objects that have been unearthed already in the early field work at Naucratis, but that had been previously remained unstudied and unpublished. These included casting net weights and hooks found in a cache of Egyptian votive bronzes. And these fragments add to the corpus of boat remains already known from Naucratis, such as this limestone anchor found in 2012 and a horn rail rings from the sails of an ancient square-rigged ship from Hogarth's excavations. The fragment of plank was sawn off, presumably when a ship coming into Naucratis required some maintenance. It was from the scarf end of a plank joined with mortise and tenon. Half of the tenon is preserved with its dowel hole. The plank is quite thin, only 3 centimetres at its thinnest, and is similar in scale and construction to those used for the slightly later Kyrenia ship. This suggests that this is from a small vessel, but most trading ships of the Archaic and Classical period were probably of this size. Comparative material is rare within Egypt. Remains of seagoing ships from Egypt were found in later contexts of the Hellenistic and Roman Red Sea ports of Myosormus and Berenike, and most shipwrecks from the Mediterranean are of later date, with relatively few archaic and classical shipwrecks known to us. Also, the contemporary boat remains published from the ongoing work by Frank Godio's team at the Egyptian Mediterranean port of Thonis Heraklion are of traditional Egyptian river barges known as Baris, previously cited as evidence for transshipment by barge up the Nile to Naucratis, but this now seems not to be the case, based upon our better understanding of the navigability of the Nile and the ship remains found at Naucratis. And it is from this new information that we can now reconstruct where the riverfront was, what it looked like, and how boats like the Kyrenia depicted here could have navigated the river. You'll notice here also this very large Egyptian temple of Amun-Ra to the right. Access to this temple was via a processional way lined with rams and sphinxes, with a large limestone ritual quay providing access from the river. This 8-hectare sacred area was substantially refurbished with a large monumental gate or pylon built during the reign of Ptolemy II in the 3rd century BC. Artists and designers are now helping us present our geophysics and excavation results for a general audience, such as this artist's impression by Kate Morton from the British Museum and 3D models by a designer from Southampton University, Grant Cox. These incorporate all previous research, including the discoveries of recent rescue excavations by our Egyptian colleagues. Our excavations in the north concentrated on the sanctuaries of the Hellenion, discovered by Hogarth, and the nearby Dioscuroi, discovered by Flinders Petrie. The Hellenion was the centre of an extensive East Greek dedications, including inscriptions dedicating objects to the gods of the Greeks, a very early expression of a common Hellenic identity. But also these well-known Rhodian and other East Greek terracotta protomes found alongside dedications to Aphrodite. Our own geophysics suggests much more of these sanctuaries is preserved to the north, so we focused our attention in 2014 and 15 on 9 trenches in this area, supervised by Aurelia Masson and Astrid Lindenhoff. The material discovered and recorded by Petrie and Hogarth was predominantly Greek, but with small amounts of Cypriot and Phoenician material, also now identified from their excavations. These date from the late 7th through to the beginning of the 3rd century BC. In 2014, we were able to locate the outer Temenos wall of the Hellenion, first recorded by Hogarth. It was abutted on the outside by an undisturbed deposit of 6th century BC votives, including the heads of pig and sheep, possibly sacrifice animals, but also Greek sanctuary pottery alongside Egyptian, Cypriot and Phoenician vessels belonging to the neighbouring sanctuary of Dioscuroi. In 2015, we found the continuation of this wall and structures behind it. This was evidence for a 1 metre high casemate mud brick platform, Egyptian technology of that period, used as a foundation on which to build the Greek sanctuary. This covered a large area, at least 50 metres across, but probably originally covered the whole of the Hellenion, which covers over 2 hectares. The Hellenion was used until the Roman period, and large quantities of Hellenistic pottery and other objects, such as these figurines and the amphora handle, were found in this and the surrounding area. These were, however, disturbed by the Victorian excavations, and it is only the earlier 7th and 6th century BC layers that are undisturbed in this area. Within these early layers, next to the outer wall of the massive casemate mud brick platform, was found a smaller mud brick platform with evidence of burning, perhaps used for an outdoor altar, and further votive deposits. Yet the material in these deposits, in fact, belongs to the neighbouring sanctuary of the Dioscuroi, which was clear from the find of a dedication to the Dioscuroi, which is always very handy. The rich finds in the area include much pottery, fragments of Cypriot limestone sculpture, but also Greek and Egyptian figurines. Now, the geophysics and excavations have also informed our research into what the settlement looked like, and it is now clear from the new evidence that much of the town was populated with tall tower houses, the standard architecture of the period that commonly had between 3 to 6 stories, and were depicted on numerous house models known from Egypt, including examples from Naucratis. These are similar in construction to those found to this day in Yemen. This was the architecture of choice used by Egyptians, but also Persians, Jews, and Greeks across Egypt at this time, and it's now clearly represented in the archaeological remains. So with our 3D reconstruction, we should imagine a mud brick Manhattan, populated with tall tower houses and large sanctuaries, befitting a large and cosmopolitan city. So I put in here some correctly dressed for scale terracottas from the 4th and 3rd centuries BC. Of course, any reconstruction based on a plan is hampered by our understanding of the density of settlement at any one time, which was contemporaneous, what was contemporaneous, or even in disrepair. But the ongoing process of reconstruction is a useful academic exercise involving numerous specialists and artists and makes us consider what gaps there are in our evidence. These hypothetical models are in progress but give some impression of what the site may have looked like, what the lived experience may have been like, with the high buildings with their wooden drains disgorging onto the muddy, narrow streets. The final reconstructions will be used on the website to allow the general public to explore Naucratis, but will be accompanied with articles explaining what levels of certainty we can apply to these models. So our first attempts at a digital reconstruction were already made in 2012, but our knowledge has greatly increased since then. Nonetheless, the results serve to illustrate how much our new fieldwork has improved our understanding of the site, its size, density, and demographic makeup. Naucratis was larger and more densely packed than previously thought, supporting a population of 16,000. The majority of this site remains to be excavated, and the superb preservation and rich finds make this an important site for future investigation.
New research is transforming our view of Naucratis in many ways. And Ross has shown you what we know now about the city, the river, and the ships that sailed the canopic branch of the Nile on their way to Naucratis. But there is also much new that we are discovering about the people of Naucratis and their interaction with each other and with others beyond the town itself, locally, regionally, and internationally. One of the most important points is the realization that the new findings contradict a commonly held view, especially among classicists, that at least in its early days, Naucratis was essentially a Greek foundation and a Greek town. Instead, as you have heard already, the excavations of this year and last year are beginning to paint a far richer and more complex and complete picture of Naucratis, in which Egyptians, as well as Cypriots and Phoenicians, play a prominent role. Of particular importance in this context is the votive deposit of the 6th century BC that we uncovered in the sanctuary of the Dioscuri. The cult of the Dioscuri, the twin sons of Zeus, Castor and Pollux, was one of the most popular cults in early Naucratis, hardly surprising for this trading town, as the Dioscuri were considered divine patrons and protectors of seafarers, whom they also guided as bright stars, bringing light to the black ship in the night of trouble, as the early poet Alcaios put it, just around the time when Naucratis was being founded. In the deposit in this sanctuary area, we found elaborate sanctuary crockery and religious offerings similar to those that already Petrie, Gardner, and Hogarth had discovered and brought back from Naucratis and that are today in the British Museum and in 70 other collections around the world, and that we've now gathered again in our online catalogue for the first time after the excavations to see together and, you know, in one spot again. Including carved limestone figurines from Cyprus, fragments of fine decorated pottery, mostly drinking cups, brought by traders and travelers from their home cities, such as Miletus or Teos, as well as from the major pottery producing centers of the Greek world, Athens, Corinth, Sparta, and Chios. But we also found all those objects that Petrie and co. must have found as well, but did not keep and bring back, such as bones from the animals that were sacrificed and consumed during the ritual feasts in the sanctuary, that tell us much about ritual, local fauna, and husbandry of the period. Most importantly, however, we encountered masses of coarser and less highly decorated pottery, Greek trade amphorae that arrived in Egypt filled with wine and oil, Phoenician torpedo amphorae, Cypriot basket-handled amphorae, as well as Cypriot mortaria, grinding bowls for foodstuff, evidence for the commodity trade on the back of which the finer offerings would have traveled. But the greatest surprise was the amount of local Egyptian pottery, and much of it of a kind that would be quite appropriate also in an Egyptian religious context. So when we compare what we found with a pottery sample that was brought back by the 19th century excavators, it becomes clear just how biased their selection, and thus our picture of the site until recently, really is. Over 90% of the pottery preserved from the early fieldwork is Greek, creating the impression of a predominantly Greek site. But what we encountered is nearly 80% Egyptian, and including almost as much Cypriot and Levantine material as Greek. And this even though we were excavating here in a Greek sanctuary and not an Egyptian context. All this leaves no doubt that right from the beginning, the Egyptian element and the Levantine connections of Naucratis was substantial. And it further underlines that Naucratis was not an isolated Greek enclave, but a trading port that fulfilled important functions, both for Greeks and Egyptians, as well as for others, that was established as part of the expanding diplomatic and economic relations between Egypt and Greece during the major political and economic realignments in the later 7th century BC ancient world. Further confirmation for inter-ethnic contact and a certain degree of symbiosis comes from other quarters, such as evidence for craft production, a Greek potter's workshop that adopted elements of local technology, or loom weights of both Greek and Egyptian type. It is also now clear that the Egyptian sanctuary of Amun-Ra at Naucratis, which you have seen in the reconstructions, dates back to the beginning of the site. But our most important evidence is the large body of locally produced figurines that Ross has been studying in detail. As you have already seen, the new excavations at the riverfront revealed two figurines of a phallic nature, as well as a fragment of a plaque showing a nude female, probably Isis Hathor. They are, in fact, not exceptional. Hundreds of similar figurines are also preserved from the early fieldwork at Naucratis, dating from the 6th century BC onwards. These phallic figurines in particular were so frequent among the finds that the 19th century scholars coined the term naucratic figures for these erotic images and hid them away in the first reaches of the museum basements without publishing a single one of them. So this was quite a discovery for us when we descended into the basements. Today we know that these figurines are actually not unique to Naucratis, but are common for late period Egypt, especially in the Nile Delta, and that they have a clear religious function. They are part of religious rites concerning fertility, and especially the fertility resulting from the yearly inundation of the Nile. linked to the worship of Isis Hathor, Osiris, Horus the Child, and Harpocrates. The fact that we find such figures at Naucrates and that we find them in considerable numbers is a clear sign that traditional Egyptian religion was practiced here, and thus a clear sign of an Egyptian element in the population of Naucrates and quite probably also intermarriage. This insight has important ramifications well beyond the confines of Naucrates itself for our understanding of Greek-Egyptian relations in general. Close daily contact would have provided the Greeks of Naucrates with a lived experience of Egyptian culture that provides an entirely new background against which we can reassess the long-debated question of the nature and extent of Egyptian influence on early Greek culture, art, architecture, philosophy, and so on, but also of the role played by foreigners in the fundamental changes that affected late-period Egypt at the same time. The spread of a new script, demotic, the monetization of the Egyptian economy, among others. Together with the Greek mercenaries living in Egypt, the Greek traders of Naucrates are likely to have been major agents in this early cross-cultural interchange, which in many ways prefigures developments that used to be considered characteristic only of much later Ptolemaic times. Of course, all this is also part of a far wider picture. That sees an increasing participation of Egypt in a larger Mediterranean and Levantine cultural koine. We can trace this at Naucrates too, since it is clear that other ethnicities were also present here. Carians, Lydians, Persians, Phoenicians, and Cypriots. Phoenicians may have been involved in the establishment of a faience workshop as early as the early 6th century BC at Naucrates. While in the later 5th century BC, some Cypriots left behind dedications in a Cypro-syllabic script in the Greek sanctuaries of Naucrates. And in the 4th century BC, a Cypriot sculptor carved a statue of Heracles at Naucrates. The link between Naucrates and Cyprus was especially strong and long-lasting, and substantial quantities of Cypriot imports reached Naucrates from its earliest days. Cypriot figurines were dedicated in the earliest phases of the site's Greek sanctuaries, as Ross has already mentioned. And they represent a range of materials, terracotta, limestone, and gypsum, alabaster, as well as types, Syrianizing, Egyptianizing, Cypro-Ionian, as well as production centers. As we can see when we plot the spatial distribution of these figurines, they make up a large proportion. Of figure dedications at Naucrates, especially in the early levels of the Apollo and Aphrodite sanctuary, eclipsing even Greek figurines. When we look at the sanctuaries in detail, we see that the range of figurines offered in each of them is extremely varied. I'll show you here some examples from the Apollo sanctuary in particular and the Hellenion and Hera sanctuary. As well, here a range from the Aphrodite sanctuary. They even include little toy animals on wheels. Many of the figurines were probably brought to Naucrates, not by Cypriots themselves, though, but by Greeks, as, for example, the impressive figure of a young hunter who was dedicated to Aphrodite by a Greek, Callias. The widespread presence in the sanctuaries of Naucrates and many other sanctuaries in the Eastern Aegean and even the Black Sea area highlights the important role that Cyprus played in the trade networks that linked the Mediterranean with Egypt. Was copper trade the driving force behind this, as already in the Bronze Age? And did Egypt rely on Cyprus to fuel the boom in its bronze industry from the 8th and 7th centuries BC onwards? Many such bronze figurines made specifically for dedication in Egyptian temples have also been found at Naucrates. And we are currently trying to see if we can pin down the origin of the raw materials used in their production as part of one of our scientific analysis projects in which Aurélia Masson is currently involved. A further group of objects that still remains to be fully exploited for the information it can give us on trade patterns, and again, we are relying on Aurélia, is weights. Over 1,000 weights are preserved from the early excavations at Naukratiza. Many of them are currently held in Chicago, where Aurélia catalogued them recently, a major effort. But like so many other finds from Naukratiz, these had never been looked at since Petri brought them back from Naukratiz, even though Petri himself very much realized their importance. They encompass a great variety of different origins and standards, including even counterfeit weights. Cheating is not a modern invention. These are our examples here. As we find when we study material from Naukratiz, each group of objects sheds light on a different aspect or aspects of the site. Thus, the painted pottery dedications in the Greek sanctuaries, excavated by Petri and Hogarth already in large numbers and brought back from Naukratiz, give us vital clues about the people trading at and traveling via Naukratiz, about their trading routes and their trading partners. Traders such as Sostratos, successful trader from Aegina, and supposedly, according to Herodotus, the wealthiest trader of his time. Or Charaxos, brother of the poetess Sappho of Lesbos, who lost his heart and his fortune to one of the famed courtesans of Naukratiz, as Sappho laments in one of her poems. The rich pottery these traders and travelers left behind as remnants of their ritual feasts and as gifts for the gods allows us to chart the flow of trade and traffic that passed through this keynote in Eastern Mediterranean networks. As you can see in this chart, so the peak in the pottery dedication activity is in the early decades of the 6th century BC, and it is matched by a contemporary peak in the dedication of Cypriot figurines, suggesting that these two are part of the same phenomenon. Greek traders traveling trade routes on which Cyprus was one of the key stopping points. But we also need to be careful, as such charts can also lead us astray, especially when they are based exclusively on material preserved from the early excavations, which is incomplete and biased. You see here the apparent drop in imported Greek pottery as well as figurines from the later 6th century BC onwards. Does this signify a decline in trade and a decline in the significance of Naukratiz? It is only through the fieldwork of the past two seasons that we can finally answer this question definitively and with a resounding nope, because this finally provides us with untouched assemblages of good chronological coverage and thus allows us to put the early fieldwork in perspective and correct its biases. I have already shown you the apparent dominance of Greek fineware pottery at Naukratiz as a 19th century fiction that resulted from a neglect of the plentiful plainer wares. As we now see in our trench on the riverfront, much the same is also true for the plainer Greek finewares. High-quality black lace pottery is plentiful in our 5th and 4th century context, but rare among the material from Petri, Gardner, or Hogarth's fieldwork, who only kept sherds with inscriptions, and they make up a very small percentage of this imported material. The supposed drop in imported finewares is thus a mirage, resulting from 19th century selection practices amplifying changes in patterns of pottery production, distribution, and consumption. A temporary decline of the East Greek cities that used to dominate trade with Egypt and their pottery production following the Persian conquest of Ionia, the subsequent rise of Athens as the dominant economic and political power, as well as the center of art and craftsmanship, the increased consumption of fine black lace wares, and an overall decline of dedications on painted pottery in sanctuaries. It does not, however, reflect a general downturn in trade or in consumption of imports at Naucratis. In fact, Naucratis continued to be a major nexus of international trade in the 5th and 4th centuries, and well beyond that. As the large corpus of stamped amphora handles from Naucratis, studied by our collaborator Alan Johnston, present here today as well, shows, wine from Rhodes, as well as Kos, Knidos, and Thassos, reached Naucratis in some quantity throughout the late classical and Hellenistic periods. Nonetheless, the site did not remain unaffected by historical events, as we can see when we look at yet another group of finds, the stone and terracotta figurines. You have already seen the many Cypriot figurines that were dedicated at the site, and Ross has also shown you some of the many figurines that were imported from East Greece and mainland Greece in the 6th and 5th centuries. But from the 4th century BC, foreign imports of figurines declined significantly in favor of locally produced figures of Egyptian type, many of which, as I've already mentioned earlier, had special significance in fertility rites and inundation festivals. The prime reason for this change must be the foundation of Alexandria, the new international harbor town that now attracted the long-distance traders and travelers who once used to sail further up the Nile to Naucratis. Naucratis increasingly became a more normal trading port, even if it still remained exceedingly busy and clearly retained special status. We see that, for example, in the fact that in the early 3rd century BC, Ptolemy I and Ptolemy II rebuilt the local sanctuary of Amun-Ra in a truly monumental scale, including a pylon that counts among the largest in Egypt. This fuller and more nuanced picture of Naucratis and the statistically valid data derived from the new fieldwork also helps us understand the site and its history in a wider context, including Naucratis' relationship with other trading ports such as Thonis Heraklion, its contemporary sister harbour at the mouth of the Canopic branch, recently rediscovered in French underwater excavations. The symbiotic relationship of the two harbour towns is exemplified by the near identical stelae recording a pharaonic tax decree that names the two cities as key points of trade and taxation of trade that were erected at both ports in the earlier 4th century BC. So we can now begin to build up a picture of regional and international contact and exchange for the first millennium BC, just as Ross has recently been able to do already for later Roman periods, based on data from the American survey at Naucratis in the 1970s and 80s. As the chart shows, Naucratis follows a similar pattern to Alexandria and the Mareotis region, including participating in the same international trade that covers Africa and the Mediterranean world. With this, we also reach the final phases in the history of Naucratis. The port had risen to significance as a nexus of diplomatic and economic links between Egypt and Greece. It had remained of vital importance as a trading port for the shipment of grain to feed the hungry cities of the Greek world and subsequently Rome and Constantinople. Even when Alexandria took over as the main international Mediterranean port of Egypt, grain ships still passed through Naucratis along the Canopic branch. But when, following the Rashidun Caliphate invasions of AD 642, these routes shifted east towards the Red Sea and ultimately Mecca and Medina, Naucratis was no longer required. As the Stygian and Naucratis canals were no longer maintained and the Canopic River became increasingly difficult to navigate, the port of Naucratis fell into disuse. Throughout the existence of Naucratis, it was the city's relations with the river and its role as an international harbour that determined the city's fate. Our revisiting the site in the footsteps of the pioneers of archaeology has shed much new light on this relationship, on the river's location and its development, the port's trading activities and the mixed character of its population, and on its relations with the Mediterranean world, including Phoenicia, Cyprus and the Levant. It has also highlighted the enormous potential the site still holds for for further insights into all aspects of Naucratis and its wider context. Our work on the riverfront has only just literally scratched the surface. A large stretch of the riverfront is still waiting to be explored, as do many untouched areas and buildings across the areas of the Greek and Egyptian sanctuaries, as well as in the town area. Under the expert leadership of Ross and in close collaboration with our Egyptian colleagues, we expect future fieldwork seasons to unravel yet more of the secrets of this harbour town on the cusp of two great civilizations. In addition, work has just begun on a restudy of archaeological data collected by the American team in the 1970s and 80s in the region around Naucratis, which should help us to better understand Naucratis in its wider geographical context. Research also continues on finds from the old fieldwork, and I've already mentioned the weights and the scientific investigation of possible metal imports from Cyprus. Last but not least, we want to make our research more accessible to the scholarly community and to a wider public. Our project's website and online catalogue are already, we think, fabulous tools for research and education. But there is room for improvement, including making key information available also in Arabic. We hope you will be interested in following our progress with all of this also in future, in our publications and online on the BM website, and of course in our reports for the Honor Frost Foundation, for whose support we are immensely grateful. But I want to conclude with a special invitation, because soon you will also have the opportunity to experience the results of our work on Naucratis and our collaboration with colleagues working on the neighboring sites of Tonis, Heraclean, and Canopus, in a close encounter with some of the most stunning monuments that tell the story of Egyptian-Greek maritime relations, the Sunken Cities exhibition at the British Museum, curated by our team member Aurélia Masson, and a related spotlight exhibition that will be touring the UK, both to open in May next year. And very much hope to see you there, and thank you for listening.
They are willing to take questions, so I think we should at least have, if anybody wishes questions, we have a microphone, so if you want a question, please wait for the microphone. Who wants to be the first? Claude, hold on.
Yes.
How many? Just that one?
There are two fragments. There are numerous examples.
From Naucratis, we have at least two fragments of house, those tower houses, of the models of them. But from the geophysics, it's quite clear that the majority of the domestic areas have the floor plan of that construction.
So they come from a domestic context?
Yes.
All of them? The three?
Oh, no, well, we don't necessarily... We know they come from the town, but from the old excavations, we don't know exactly what the context is. So there's always a possibility that they might have come from a small shrine or something. That's a bit of a problem with some of the old excavations.
Yeah. And the date, exactly? You date them?
To the late period, but some do go into the Ptolemaic and Roman period. So you have these sort of models that continue on. There is a researcher at the British Museum who just completed her PhD on the subject of tower houses in Egypt and doing reconstructions of them at Tel El Daba, which has been very useful to our research as well.
And their context, if you can tell me, they are domestic?
They're usually domestic, but when you have a context, but as you can imagine, many models and figurines that are in collections around the world are from old excavations where that's
so we don't know.
Yeah, so it's difficult to say for all of them.
Thank you.
No, actually, could you wait? Because actually, they're recorded.
Okay.
So in addition to the figurines and dedications that you have in the sanctuaries, did you also, in the archaic period, did you also find any weapon evidence? Any weapons? There were
weapons.
Of any kind?
Arrowheads in the Sanctuary of Apollo, going right through to the Ptolemaic period. So from the Archaic right through to the Ptolemaic, and of types that are typical from all over the Eastern Mediterranean and also Egypt. So we often find within the Egyptian, the Greek temples, Cypriot, obviously, Levantine, but also Egyptian figurines reinterpreted. So figurines of Isis Hathor dedicated in the Aphrodite sanctuary, for example.
Hello. So from the prospections you made to locate the canal, can you tell that there's absolutely nothing west of the river?
West of the Abu Diab Canal is a different permit area, and we're not allowed. We have tried. Our geologist suspects that the river is actually much larger. The whole riverbed is much larger than 200 metres across, but of course that wouldn't have been navigable all year round. So he thinks there's a sort of floodplain area beyond that. But the current course of the Abu Diab Canal seems to be based upon the Ayyubid or Mamluk period canal attempt to resupply Alexandria with water at that time. So it's not a matter that the canal was not maintained, it's just that the Canopic River branch sort of dried up, and then there were various attempts to redig this during the Islamic period. And the interesting thing about that is that the new canal then respects the new site, not Naucratis. So we have no evidence, certain evidence, after the 7th century AD from Naucratis, yet we do have from Nibiru, the other side of the canal, Fatimid evidence. So suddenly we have later period Islamic. Nothing until the Ottoman.
Has this brought collaboration with the Egyptian department at the, I mean, do you all work closely together on these finds? Is it a
Of course, every department. In fact, there are Naucratis objects currently in 5 departments in the British Museum. The way things get divvied up in the Victorian period is quite strange. But so we have collaborations with numismatists in the Department of Coins and Medals. There are even examples in the Prehistory in Europe department, because they were Byzantine objects, and there are pieces in the Middle East department that were incorrectly assigned to Palmyra, bizarrely, and have subsequently been reacquainted. So.
Yes, it looked from the pictures that we saw that there are no standing structures left at Naucratis today, no buildings. And yet in so many parts of Egypt, there are so many standing structures. Do you have an explanation for why there isn't anything there?
The majority of the architecture in the delta of Egypt is mud brick. There are no local sources of stone. So this makes for a very flat topography. Also, the way that the site has been modified over the years by agriculture has meant that a lot of these structures have been leveled. There were actually very high mud brick structures. The warehouse where they, within the Egyptian temple precinct, where they probably kept much of the trade goods that they taxed, was still preserved to quite a high level. So unfortunately, that was completely leveled. And it actually had a Coptic church on top of it as well, and that was leveled after the Victorian period, unfortunately. But we now know from our own excavations that and our research into the old excavations, that there's over 13 metres of stratigraphy preserved in places. It looks very flat, but actually under those towns, there's a lot of archaeology. And areas of the Hellenian are preserved to maybe a metre, and then just to the north you have over 6 metres of stratigraphy. So there is a lot of archaeology there. It's quite difficult to access, and water is a problem.
Do we know what the Temple of Amun-Ra would have been made of?
We know that large sections of it were mud brick and lined with stone. We have fragments of these. In fact, our Egyptian antiquities inspectors found some more fragments, decorated fragments. I mean, maybe Aurelia would like to discuss them in more detail, but there's a procession, I believe, represented on these fragments, and they found them within the foundation of a very old mosque, actually, and it was reappropriated. So a lot of the stone objects get recycled because they all had to be brought in from Memphis or Alexandria or further afield.
I would be very interested in some sort of sense of scale. I don't know how high these buildings were, how big they were, what was the population at its peak. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
The population was probably in excess of 16,000, a rather conservative estimate on the basis of the density of the houses as we've got from the plans that we've been able to recreate. So about 16,000 people is a conservative estimate of it at its peak. The buildings would have exceeded 20 metres high in places, as maybe we can see from the reconstruction. These are each a floor. So you had 5-6-storey high buildings in these areas, and these have really quite ginormous footings and foundations for these structures and in fact large basements as well. So even the domestic architecture was quite large, and the temple architecture was very grand as well, going right back to the 6th century BC. There were Greek sanctuaries with temples using marble from Ephesus painted using the technology of the time and the pigments copied from Egyptian technology, but nevertheless reinterpreted by the Greeks. So it was a very grand place, but unfortunately, as often happens in the Delta and other places where limestone and building material is limited, a lot of this material gets reused and in fact gets fired in lime kilns because all of these mud brick houses need lime on the outside. So as you'll probably recognise, those of you who've been to Yemen, limestone blocks, so this massive pylon for the Temple of Amun-Ra was sort of sheathed in limestone, and fragments of that were found by Flinders Petrie. This was the same size of the large pylon at Karnak, so this was a really substantial structure. So those of you who've been to Karnak will get some idea of the scale of this. Obviously, it's been massively robbed out, but there are always fragments, and there are always, I get some idea of the foundations and the lower floors of these ginormous buildings.
Yes. Do you have any sense of what happened in the early Islamic period? Because there's quite a few saying that it continued until the sort of the Rashidun Caliph's period, and then when you go over to the canal on the other side, you've got Fatimid period occupation. So you've got a couple of hundred years there. So do you get any sense, is there any Arabic source material that talks about this city?
Not for Naucratis. I mean, there's some Coptic literature which discusses, but it's always a bit unclear as to whether they're the exact events they're referring to, there's Coptic literature on the saints, martyrs of Naucratis, for example, which refer to 4th century AD events. But what we seem to get at Naucratis, what's absent at Naucratis is this early Islamic period, which is very well represented in the immediate region. So in surveys in the area, there are all of the farming hamlets continue, but we just don't have that evidence for that material there. And we thought we had some evidence, and then we found out that Petrie had acquired it from Nibiru. So so it does seem like some point between the 7th century and the 9th century, the site is abandoned. Although with a lot of the ceramic evidence, it's difficult to be that specific because there's a lot of continuity in forms from the end of the Byzantine period into the very early Islamic.
I may have missed something, but this expression, mistress of the ships,
yes.
Where does that come from?
It's a very good question. And it's a very complicated answer. I'm not sure I'm the best person to answer it, because there are different interpretations depending on whether you're coming from a classical background or whether you're coming from an Egyptological background, because there is an Egyptian. I think the best thing here would be to have invite Aurelia and Alexandra up to argue their different...
Well, it's a very nice name, of course, for a trading port, mistress of ships. Now Krate is a sort of ruler of ships in a way. So we, as classicists, always assumed that this was, of course, what the Greeks had called this port, which they founded in Egypt. But then we were told by the Egyptologists and by the philologists among the Egyptologists that this was impossible because the Egyptian name of the place, which is recorded in Egyptian inscriptions at about the same time that we also have the earliest mentions of the Greek word Naukratis, Nokraj is the Egyptian name, that this cannot be derived from the Greek term Naukratis, but it has to have gone the other way. On philological ground, absolutely impossible to have gone this way. So if you want to...
Just a little addition is that the ancient Egyptian name of Nokraj might have a Libyan, actually, origin. And we know also two other names for Naukratis, Egyptian name, Permerit, the domain of the port, and as well as Badet, which is the epithet of the main Egyptian god revered in Naukratis, Amun-Ra Badet. That's all we know. I mean, the real what we can so far gather from the restudy and new excavation from Naukratis is that we have nothing before, really, surely before the late 7th century BC. So it would be difficult to say that Naukratis come from an early Libyan occupation. So far, it hasn't been confirmed at all. So.
Well, that was completely enthralling. Thank you so much. It's been a real eye-opener to those of us who don't know a lot about your beautiful mistress of the ships, to tell us about this incredible trading, the diversity of the finds you've got, and the future of your excavations. Thank you. Thank you. It's been marvellous. Please, can we signify this with a round of applause? Secondly, I want to say thank you to Joan, who has been our stalwart executive director since we started. Her dedication to the Honor Frost Foundation has been second to none. She has thrown her heart and soul into it, and we are so appreciative of everything she's done for us, and we're very, very sad to see her go. Thank you so much, Joan. You've been wonderful. Thirdly, it's time for a drink.